Session number 7363.
Mr. Jameson, tape 11. Mr. Jameson, we were talking about the super heavy guns and what you experienced.
Yeah.
You were explaining the situation.
I saw... I didn't see anything beyond a 9-inch. They were enormous things. You know, the platform and everything would fill the whole of this room very nearly. Terrific things. And, of course, moved by tractors. And... terrific job of providing them with the necessary shells and cartridges and whatnot. And I can remember just one thing that I can remember about that. I was going, I forget where I was going, but I was riding back and it was on that mule-headed horse there. It used to decide it wouldn't go sometimes, and I used to have to knock it about a bit to make it behave. But we got alongside this big gun position on one occasion, and of course they'd got trenches all round it, and this thing started to play me up and eventually landed smack in one of these trenches. Fortunately, I sort of kicked my feet out of the stirrups and lay back a bit so that I didn't get my legs crushed, and I got off it, you see, just like this, standing, and there was the horse down here, and I had to get some of these fellows to help me get it out. I didn't have any, apart from that, I didn't have any close experience of heavy stuff. When we were at Newport, we did have a battery of 6-inch guns, with these things, a terrific long muzzle, and they were about a couple of hundred yards behind us, but we had to ask if they could be moved because of their crack. It was very harsh, and they're a flat trajectory gun, you know, and terrific velocity, a 6-inch. And they used to absolutely drive our eardrums in every time they fired, so they were too close to us, we had to get them to move.
Going back and, you know, finalising the Battle of the Somme, was there a victory by either side at that battle, would you say? What was gained by it?
Well,
you as a soldier, how did you react to it?
I don't think we reacted beyond feeling it was another bit of the war. It was going on. There was a terrific amount of fighting, a terrific amount of shell fire, and all for the gain of a few hundred yards of ground. Now, of course, we couldn't say whether gaining that few hundred yards of ground was tactically worth it because it happened to be in a commanding position, because the ground was like that, you see, or whether it was not worth it. But it didn't seem to me that we captured very much on the Somme for a tremendous amount of effort. It wasn't until later, when the German ability to resist was being worn down, they were beginning to get short of rations, it was quite obviously the indication, and sorted sort of way to find it out, but along a railway embankment, I remember Drew Common saying, look, the Jerry's aren't getting any meat anymore, look at that, you see.
Why was that?
Light-coloured excreta all the way along this thing, no sign of meat, you see. And we knew that there weren't in many ways, but this was very evident, you see. They'd used this as a latrine right along this railway embankment. And he said, well, they're certainly not getting any meat, are they? Now, the other nationality we came across were the New Zealanders. Now, we liked them very much. We liked the New Zealanders.
What was it about them you liked?
I don't know. They were just different. They were more like us in some ways. They were easier to get on with. And when we were... Of course, this is jumping the gun quite a lot, but it was towards the end of the war when we were around Kerrier and going on towards the end. And we came on this town, which I know quite well, and I've got pictures of it, Kerrier. It was a walled fortress in a way. It had walls as thick as half this room thick, you see, and a moat all round. It was a very ancient town. And there was a Prussian general in there with a lot of troops, and he was holding it, and we were at that time moving on quickly. We were firing from about six gun positions in the day, least. Moving rapidly is more like open warfare. And we were contacting battalions by Galloper to keep in touch, you see, to find out where they were going next, and we would shoot off after them. It was a great battle. And coming along towards this place, you see, we suddenly bumped into this New Zealand bloke, and he said, "Get in the ditch, for God's sake." He said, "There's a ruddy old Prussian general in there, and he's holding everything up." But he said, "Actually, we've decided just to leave him alone. The troops have gone on, and they're, he told us where they'd gone. He said, we've left that to be dealt with later. Hopefully he'll surrender, but at the moment he's got machine guns, and if he sees a head go up anywhere, it'll get wiped off." So this New Zealander fellow was very helpful.
They were good fighters too, were they?
They were very good fighters, yes, they were very good.
How about South Africans? Any South Africans?
I didn't see any. I can't remember seeing any. Come in!
What happened to you after the Somme battle? What sort of action were you involved with after the Somme?
Well, that was the peculiar function of army brigades, you see. They didn't stay to hold the line once a battle had been fought. The generals were then thinking about where the next offensive would happen, and army brigades were promptly on the move to go there and to sort themselves out and get settled in. And the next offensive was the Canadians were going to take the Vimy Ridge. So we were sent off to get into position. We were told to home up somewhere on Mount St. Eloy, La Targette area. And that's what we did. We got ourselves away up there, found ourselves in wagon lines. The BCs went off for conferences. They were given their map reference positions and told to go up and reconnoitre, which they did, meet the Canadian commanders and so forth, and generally button up. And then we went off to have the different battalions having found their positions. We then, of course, went off to view them, and if there was any work to be done beforehand, to get cracking. Actually, if I remember rightly, we went up, the brigade went up to a position somewhere around about to the right of the Farbus Talus Road, around about La Targette, with Mount St. Eloy away in the background over here. We were given our positions, and we got our guns up there into position and registered. And then we were told, just quietly register and settle in, don't fire more than you need, and be quiet. The next thing, of course, was the meeting again at Canadian Corps headquarters with the Corps commander and his divisional generals, and a general discussion about aims and objects and how far they hope to go. And then, of course, the next meeting was with the CRA to get the fire program and ultimately to people to go up to headquarters and get watches synchronized. That, of course, was done. The day for the battle was planned, and as I say, the weather was so terrible that it was put off for 24 hours. But that didn't make very much difference, and they decided to push on with it. I don't think I've been present. They were very anxious the Canadian show should be a success. They were very anxious also that they should take the ridge. And I don't think I can remember anywhere where the concentration of firepower was greater than there. That'll be demonstrated later, because we got ourselves up into position, we registered and waited, and then, of course, on the morning, that was when John Dickinson was killed, as I told you, going up with the battalion commander to button up with the as liaison officer with the Canadian battalion and what we're supporting. At zero hour approach, of course, the place was dead quiet. What the Canadians had been doing during that time, and I hope, as a matter of fact, I shall go back again to Vimy, and this time I'll have another dig into the tunnels. Because what we did prior to this show was the Canadians had dug these tunnels towards the German lines, and they had put air vents up. And where the Canadian front line was, the conformation of the ground was such that if you went into the front line, you couldn't really see the German wire. It was in a fold in the ground, so that if you went up there to do wire cutting, as we always did before a show, you couldn't see what you were shooting at, you see. So somebody suggested, well, it wouldn't be a bad idea if we went along one of these tunnels and tried up one of the air vents. So, of course, there was a bit of pressure. There were only a few of these air vents available at that time, and several observation officers wanting to get in on the act. And the only way you could stick up there was to work your way up this the air vent and stick a spade in the side, you see, and stand on the shaft. One of the comical things about the war was, you see, that of course the battery commanders all wanted to go and do their own registering for this show, so all the BCs went with the telephonists, and we smaller fry stayed with the guns. They got into these tunnels, and they got upstairs and plugged themselves in, and then somebody would say, well, just a minute, I want to turn around and have a look at this, and he would be screwing away and doing his shooting and say, right, that now it's my turn. You see, somebody else would shuffle around and have a bit of look. And this moving about dislodged the shovels, and the whole lot cascaded into the bottom on top of all the poor telephonists. And, of course, we only heard about this afterwards. After that, they decided to carry on the job. It would be better if one went up at a time and had 5 or 10 minutes and come on down you, it's our turn next, and that went on. And that's what they did prior to the battle opening, cutting wire to make the job. I don't think it was a very sound idea, really, because, as I say, barbed wire, and especially the German barbed wire, which was fierce stuff, much thicker and more fierce and more barbed than ours was, it used to whip around. It's like another... No, that's another thing. It used to whip around, you see, and get into coils, dangerous sort of coils, and unless you were very careful, you got very badly ripped up. But the show went successfully. We opened up on the morning of the barrage, 0 hour, and as I say, the magnificence of seeing an opening barrage, particularly that attack on the Vimy Ridge, as far as the eye could see, these flickering lights in the dark. All the way along, and the rumble just like that, and then every now and then and then whoa, and the heavier stuff coming over the top, you see, and all that was a proper sort of orchestra going on. And then gradually the began to lighten, the day began to lighten, and as it began to lighten, it was just a complete film of like smoke along the horizon. You couldn't see a thing. However, the infantry went off all right, and they captured the ridge, and they went on down onto the plain. They went over the railway embankment beyond, which was about a mile beyond. They went on from that, and they finished up holding a line along Arleur village and Oppy on our front. Everything went very successfully. And then the Canadians were relieved, and I don't know what division it was that came in their place, but they and took over the line. Of course, by the time the Canadians had got as far as Arleur and Oppy, they were just digging in foxholes. They hadn't got a trench dug. They hadn't got as far as taking enough from the Germans to be able to occupy another German line, so they had to start and dig in for themselves. And then it was a British division that took over the front. And they're saying that the situation, we had by that time moved our we'd proposed to move our guns up to just short of the crest of the ridge. Well, the Germans only had to range on the crest, and anything that went over, we got it. You see, if it was a bit plus, that was all right for them. But the other problem was that the weather was so terrible that when we came to move, the howitzer battery was all right. They were away to our left, and they moved up into the village of Talus, and they were on road, so they could move all right. But we had to get our guns up this ground that had been sodden with rain and sleet and everything, and pocketed with shell holes everywhere. And the Canadians laid tracks, some sort of track, the kind of thing they were used to facilitate movement forward. But they couldn't do that for everybody, and when we tried to move, we had to borrow a company of infantry to take one gun at a time with drag ropes and pull it up to short of the ridge for us and pull them all up, and then we manhandled them from there and spread them out where we wanted them. But that was one of these most uncomfortable positions because, as I say, we were a ready target. Once the Germans had settled down and realized that the Canadians had stopped, and there was somebody else in there, it was obvious that somebody else was just going to hold what they'd taken so they could settle down their guns and start shooting back then. And they did. And in a week, we moved our guns at least six times. We were shelled at night. We were only in a trench, no deeper than this, you see, with a gun sheet over the top of it.
That would be about 5 feet.
Yes, that was all. A gun sheet with balks of timber across it, laid across, you see, and one of these Army and Navy oil lamps that has no funnel on it, and a little wind thing that blew up to keep the flame going steady so you don't have a glass to break. And we used that to do all our working out. But constant shelling of this place, and we just didn't know when we might go west. It was purely a question of the luck, whatever. And every time we were shelled at night, we would move the guns during the day about 50 or 100 yards to a flank, and the next night that would get just as much, and we'd move it back a bit, and then we'd move it another way. We were doing this sort of thing for a week, and we were all absolutely whacked, and lack of sleep, lack of rest of any sort, lack of relaxation of any sort, just this constant hammering, you know. It was that sort of stuff. And that's when this fellow Husky Jake leapt out into the night with Max gumboots and came back in about half an hour, muddy mess and the gumboots full of water. And then Max said, "You damn fool, those were my gumboots." And of course, the difference in height didn't fit him. He was running about in his socks, you see, in the mud, and he'd land in the shell hole. Well, we...
Did he sort of rush out in desperation?
Yes, he was just driven mad, you know. This hammering business was going on, and we were trying to work out barrages, you see, and get our guns fed with the information so that they could shoot an emergency at any time. And while that was going on, you see, this hammering of shell fire all round us, never knowing when one was going to just drop on us. The mud was a friend in this respect, that the shell fire dropping anywhere, it didn't spread as far as it would normally have spread if it had been dry. But the detonations were nerve-shattering the whole time. And Lancaster, Husky Jake, just couldn't stand this. After a while, he said, "God, I can't stand this any longer." And he grabbed a pair of gumboots, thinking they were his own, and ran out, thinking to pull them on, but of course couldn't pull them on, and still kept running. And he went into the night. Where he went, we don't know, except that he did go into, must have gone to a shell hole in the state of them when he came back. But when he came back, of course, he was mud from head to foot, still in his socks, these things in his hand full of water, and MacDonald, the irate little Scot, glaring at him and saying, "You damn fool, those are my gumboots." No sympathy, you know. But Drew said when the ammunition came up, he sent him off back. He said, "No good keeping him with us." He said, he's just knocked to pieces. Send him to the wagon lines for a while and see if he can shake himself together." So he was packed out away. Well, after we'd been hammered like this, Drew said, "The weather turned fine." And he said, "Come on, Jimmy, we're going for a walk." He said, "I'm tired of losing a night's sleep." He said, "I'm dying for a bit of peace and comfort. Let's go for a walk." So we went down through these stunted trees, down this 1 and 4, or 1 and 3 slope of the ridge. It was just like this, you know, with trees chopped off about this high and bracken all round. We went on for about a mile to this railway embankment, and we studied the ground a bit there, and he said, "No, that's not for me." Gunners were having about 60% casualties at that time. It was terrific. The number of batteries that were being knocked out. He said, "No, we're not going to risk." He said, "I think we ought to be saucy. I think we'll..." We climbed over this railway embankment and went on towards the front line. And we came into this little depression. And "This looks as though there's been a little bit of an effort of some support troops scratching a little hole or two in the ground." Now, he said, if we set to work and scratch a little bit more, and if we get some poles and camouflage netting down at the same time, we'll rig that right away and then start to work underneath it. We'll get a couple of gun teams down at a time, and we'll just use 4 guns up at the top shooting when we have to. They can get on making a couple of gun pits. By the time they're ready, we'll get the whole battery onto taking one gun down at a time down this broken up forest and plant it, and then go back and bring the other one down. And that's what we eventually did. We got the 6 guns down there, and the camouflage netting, and a camouflage laid across towards the road that went back through Willowvale, which was just on our left, the ruins of it, so that there were no tracks to show coming back and forth. And we were at that time, of course, we were the only battery as far forward as that, although some of them followed us in about 2 or 3 days. But for a while we were isolated there, and ours was the only line of information of any sort that was going back to brigade or division, in fact. And it was then that Drew said to me, "I want you to get up to the battalion in front here and find out exactly." We said, "We have... situation is just in the air. We don't know what we're going to shoot at. We don't know if they put up SOS signals at any time. We don't know where we should drop the curtain. Get up there and find out where they are. Sketch it out on a pad. Give me a rough idea of map spottings and send it back as quick as you can so that we can get some defensive situation laid on right away. And stick up there until you've got it all. Couple of days, probably." So that's when I set off with these telephonists. It was a lovely fine day, and it was about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and we were leapfrogging shell hole to shell hole between the salvos of 5-9 flopping around to get across to this Arla loop where the infantry were. And it was a sunk road. And I talked to the battalion commander there and told him what we were what we were hoping to do for him, and he said, good, fine. And he put me in touch with his company commanders right away, and I got the front line more or less sketched in with map references on it, and marked a distance ahead for where we should drop the barrage, and sent that back with one of my telephonists. And then that was the first night. During the next day, there'd been an attack from the Oppy side, and the battalion commander there had been killed, and my bloke sent for me and said, oh, look, Gunner, I've got to move over, division ordered me to move over to another position. He showed me where it was on the map. I've got to take over these two battalions temporarily until reinforcements can come up. I said, well, it's not much good my coming with you. I've got lines here. I haven't anything to where you're going. I'll send somebody with you. They'll go run back to the battery, and when they get back and let me know, I can come over to you. And this was in the afternoon. So he said, righto, that's what we'll do. Well, in the meantime, when he'd gone, I went off again to his company commanders and told them what had happened. I said, I expect your BC battalion commanders told you he's had to move, so you'll be prepared for all this. But in the meantime, I'm the only source of information, I'm the only source of communication that you've got back to firepower support. So if you want anything, you'll have to get in touch with me.